Okay, so the light of higher reason, we have to begin with the approach and the humility that Socrates had in saying that his primary claim, or rather the only claim, was, I don't know, right? And he said, I'm the patron saint of inquiry. All that I know is that I don't know, right? With that approach, we have to begin our talk. Can we confidently claim that we know anything at all? And a little bit of inquiry, investigation shows that the things that we so confidently say we are aware of, or we have an understanding of, is actually built on quite shaky grounds. To understand Socratic analysis, the example that is taken usually is that of an analysis of a car or analysis of a chair, and we'll begin with the chair. We are all sitting on a chair, at least in this hall. What is a chair? Do we know what we are sitting on at all? Do we know what a chair is at all? Immediate answer is, of course we know. Of course we know what a chair is. Nobody denies that. But let's try defining that, right? The first definition that we can give to the question, what is a chair, is it is a furniture made for somebody to sit upon. Now, that's a very, at the outset it may look okay, but it's not, because there are other furnitures on which people sit upon also, right? There is a bench, there's a stool, and there are many other such furnitures which is used to sit upon, which are not chairs, right? Then we may say that it is a furniture, we will refine the definition and say it is a furniture with four legs, which is made for a person to sit upon. But then there are chairs that we come across which don't have four legs, which we still call as chair, right? Some have five legs with a wheel, we still call it chair, office chair, and so on. And there are some, if four legs is the definition, then there are stools also which have four legs. What is a chair then, right? And if you say that, okay, we will move to something slightly better and say that it is something which is a furniture which is built with four legs for one person to sit upon, then also there is a problem, because you may exclude benches, for example, or sofas. But how do you define that one person? If a pregnant woman sits in a chair, then there are two. Does it stop becoming a chair because a pregnant woman sat on it? Or if two children squeeze and sit on the same chair, will it stop becoming a chair because two people sat on it and not one? So it's, you come, you take your time and think through the question of what is a chair? How do I exactly define it such that all the false positives are removed, all the false negatives which are not included are also removed, right? So if we do that, we find it very difficult to define a chair, a simple thing as a chair. And take the other example of a car, or as it happened centuries ago, when the king of Bactria, King Milinda, if I remember right, first came in contact with the monks of Nalanda University. King Milinda himself being a great chariot builder. Not only was he a charioteer and a great emperor, he was a builder of chariot, and he had this reputation to look at a chariot and immediately say everything about the chariot. Like we speak about the strength of the material and so on, right? He had that acumen to do that. And he comes in contact with a monk of Nalanda University, and the monk challenges him and tells that, see, you have the reputation of knowing everything about a chariot, but I will show you that the chariot doesn't exist. Right? How do you do that? Then the monk says, okay, this is the chariot. Let's say there are two wheels and then a front part to tie it to the horses. Then there is a pole and an umbrella for shelter and so on. It's all made of wood because they didn't have plastic those days. Right? So it's all made of wood. So the monk says, I will start dismantling the chariot one by one. First, I will remove one spoke. Then I will remove another spoke. Then the whole of the wheel. Then the another wheel. And so on and so forth. And he says, at what point does this thing which you call as chariot stop becoming a chariot and start becoming a mass of firewood? At what point does it stop becoming a chariot and becoming mass of start becoming mass of firewood? When the wheels are removed? When the seat is removed? When the umbrella is removed? When the front part is removed? You can't define it. So that's why the Kadampa school has a very interesting observation about human perception, human cogitation. It says that for any object to exist, let's say this pen to exist, there are three things necessary. One is evidently the matter that is there, which is in this case the plastic, the cap, of which the cap and the refill and other things are made of. Secondly, apart from matter, there is a structure for which to which it should adhere. The pen should adhere a certain structure for it to be called as a pen. And the brilliant part is a third cause or the third component, which they say is a human mind has to work on it. Not human mind, any mind has to work upon that object for that object to exist. If the mind doesn't work on the object doesn't exist at all. It's a very brilliant insight into human perception. Like one of the philosophers said, it seems that the most used noun in English language is time. Time is the most used noun. And he says that though it is the most used noun, what is time? If somebody doesn't ask me what is time, I know what is time. But if somebody asks me to define what is time, I should only confess that I do not know. Very difficult to define time. All this we are discussing today to show that Socrates used this kind of analysis to investigate not the nature of a chair or a chariot or a pen or time, but most crucial topics which have direct bearing upon our life, upon our decisions and so on, which are things like justice, things like courage. What is courage? What is justice? Right? What is right and wrong? What is virtue and vice? What is sanctity? What is holiness? Right? What is love? And in Platonic dialogues, you find that each dialogue is more or less devoted to one or other of these ideals, investigation of these ideas. Laches, for example, deals with courage. What exactly is courage? And Symposium deals with love, idea of love. Republic is a universe in itself. It deals with almost all the concepts, primarily with the under the umbrella of justice. Right? So, if we take this deep investigation of ideas such as justice and so on, and apply it to ourselves, our own mental conceptions, we find that we are holding quite contradictory views. And Socrates tries to bring about this in his conversation with others, because he uses a method called as elenchus, which means that I am conversing with Socrates and I give out a definition of my belief that courage is this and this. Socrates says, okay, let's consider that as one part. And then as a part of the conversation with Socrates, he will make me aware that I hold some another belief, belief number two, which is in direct contradiction with belief number one. And since I cannot hold belief of A and not A, A and contradictory to A, he shows that there are things unresolved in your mind. You have just accepted things. You have not thought through it. And an unexamined life is not worth living. Right? This is also what the Prasangika school does. The Buddhist Prasangika Madhyamika school does. They say that, okay, you tell me your belief about soul, about life and death, about virtue and vice, good and evil, and so on. And I will put it to the greatest scrutiny on mere logical, rational, reasonable grounds. And if it withstands the fire of scrutiny, then it is true. HPB quotes Sir Herschel, John Herschel, who says that the grandest and indeed the only character of truth is its capability to endure the test of universal experience. And coming out unchanged from every possible fair discussion. If any statement or any concept adheres to this, then it is true. What a brilliant idea it is. If you come to think of it, it's the most universal definition of the character of truth. Not based on belief, not based on outward authority, not based because I like it, not based on something like I don't like it. Beyond likes and dislikes, beyond all national interests, beyond all cultures, religions, beyond the conditions of the earth itself, what is universally true can only be the character of truth, right? So here we have to say or remember another dialogue from Plato called Euthyphro. Euthyphro is a gentleman, and he meets Socrates in the halls of the court, because it is the beginning of the end for Socrates, as they say, because somebody has filed a complaint against Socrates, against sedition and so on and so forth, and Socrates is going to the court to deal with all these complaint, and he meets Euthyphro. Euthyphro has come there to file a complaint against someone. And Socrates says, Euthyphro, what are you doing here? Whom do you want to complain against? Euthyphro says, I have come here to complain against my father. Against your father? He must have done something greatly wrong to you, because father is so close to you, and what mistake can he do such that you are taking him to court, you are complaining against him, lodging a complaint against him? So Euthyphro says, no, he didn't do anything wrong to me, but he committed the wrong to one of the servants of the house. This is very strange, Socrates says. What did he do? It seems that two servants were quarreling, drunk. One of them killed the other. And Euthyphro's father was so angry with the murderer that he tied his hand and foot and put him in a ditch without food and water. And he starved and died, the second servant. So Socrates hears this and says that, Euthyphro, then you must be really sure of what you're doing. You must be really aware of What is the right thing to do? And Euthyphro confidently says, absolutely. I know what is right and wrong. That's why I'm doing this. And typical Socratic nature is, he says, let me be your disciple. Teach me what is holiness. Teach me what is sanctity. Teach me what is religious worship. And Socrates says, okay, come. I have time, lot of time. Come, I'll teach you. And then the conversation begins. And the first question Socrates asks is, what is holiness? Please define it. Euthyphro says, whatever I'm doing, that's holy. My actions themselves are example of holiness. Then Socrates says, no, I want a definition of holiness. Euthyphro says, doing this is holiness, doing that is holiness, doing the other thing is holiness, and so on and so forth. Socrates says, wait. I'm not asking for you for a listing down of particular instances of holiness. I'm asking you for a universal definition of holiness. Here we are introduced with the idea of particulars and universals. Particulars is particular instances. But universal is that which makes particulars meaningful. I can write a triangle on this page. I can write triangle here. I can draw a triangle on the wall. A million people can write million kinds of triangles, isosceles, scalene, and so on. But what makes all these individual particular triangles, triangles, is a universal idea of triangleness. Because there is an abstract idea of triangle, a definition of triangle, that I can make these triangles and all of them participate in the universal. Therefore, these triangles become triangle. Therefore, I can investigate them. Therefore, I can know them. In the similar manner, he says, there must be a universal definition of holiness. Don't give me particular instances of holiness. I don't want this triangle on the paper. I want the definition of the triangle. So in that way, he takes on the conversation. And Euthyphro next says that whatever is pleasing to the gods, that is holy. Whatever is pleasing to the gods, that is holy. Now Socrates says, Euthyphro, I have a problem with this because first of all, you find that, I mean, he's referring to Greek myths, but we can apply it to even our country as well as all other religions. He says that there are different gods. All of them wish different things. There are different ways to please them. How do you find what is pleasing to the gods? What is pleasing to Athena will be displeasing to Zeus. How do you find what is pleasing to all the gods? So Euthyphro says there must be something which is pleasing to all the gods. I will stick to that. So he's refining the definition one by one, step by step. And Socrates says, okay, there is a bigger problem with that. You can't know what is pleasing to all the gods. But let's leave aside. But we'll come to the crux of the matter. And here is the beauty. Look at this. He says, what is pleasing to the gods is holy, if you take that statement. Is it pleasing to the god because it is holy? Or is it holy and therefore it is pleasing to the gods? Which comes first? Holiness comes first? Or what is pleasing to the gods comes first? Which, in the order of what they call as explanatory priority, which comes first? There is green grass, and then I write a board. This is green grass, or this grass is green. Which comes first? The explanatory language statement, or the reality that is there? The reality that is there comes first. So the reason I'm telling you this, or we are discussing this as a part of the light of higher reason, is you find a clear distinction between the reason that interlocutors use in Platonic statements and the reason which Socrates is using, where he's gradually leading the mind of the interlocutors, the people involved in the dialogue, from contradictory beliefs held to more and more refined understanding of ideas such as courage, justice, virtue, and so on. And here we find that both of them are using logic, but both of them seem to be using logic in a different manner. There is logic of one kind used by sophists such as Calliculus and Gorgias and so on, brilliant in their logic, but the very foundation is something very wrong. The foundation of logic is wrong. Logic itself is okay, but the premises on which it is based is entirely wrong. Versus Socrates, who also uses very technically sound, valid truth statements, but the foundation of that logical endeavor is based on universal principles, not based on beliefs, but universally verified principles. Right? So this is an introduction to different kinds of logic, right? And man, if you have to come to that, has powers which are instinctual, powers which are rational, and powers which are intuitional. Thomas Taylor, in fact, says that the Greek myth of Cerberus, that is the dog with the three heads, which some of us know because we have seen Harry Potter, but some of us also know because we have read Greek mythology. The dog with the three heads, it seems, symbolizes these three distinct powers in man. One is instinctual, which is common with animals. Animals also have instincts. And then there is intuitional, which is spiritual inside, direct apprehension of truth. And between intuition and instinct lies what makes us human, which is reason, intellect or reason, right? Animals don't have reason in the manner that man has. Animal intellect is very rudimentary. They don't have abstract thinking. They don't have symbolical thinking. Symbolical in the sense, all our language is symbolical. The words that I'm using are symbols, which we are interpreting in our minds, understanding them as symbols. They don't have metaphorical thinking. For example, I can get an allegorical interpretation of Ramayana or Mahabharata. Animals don't have that kind of thinking. Animals don't have consequential thinking. I can plan for the future of my child, or I can plan my future in career and family and so on, thinking for the next 40, 50, 60 years and organize my life. Animals don't do that. Animals don't have speech because they don't have grammar and logic, because the mind is not lit up, right? And animals don't have metacognition, what they call as being aware of one's own thought, right? I can now, at this very moment, like each one of you, take a particular stand such that I can take my awareness to the corner of the room, look at myself as if I am looking at a third party person, look at all my emotions, all my thinking mechanism, the ways in manner in which I am thinking, the foundation of my thinking, the greatest power, metacognition. Right? Animals don't have this. What is it? What is that power in us which makes us distinct from animals? Almost an impassable chasm. It is these powers which comes because the power of mind, self-awareness, self-consciousness is lit up in man. Right? And it is this which makes us, whether we will use our reasoning power based on our animal experience, which takes us downward and downward, or whether our reason is based on spiritual understanding. Right? So reason becomes twofold. Reason becomes twofold. There is animal in man, the human in man, and the divine in man. And the human in man is downward looking as well as upward looking. When he is downward looking, then his reasoning is all based on separateness and delusion. When he is upward looking, the same reason becomes elevated and becomes what in the Platonic system is called as a dialectic. Dialectic. To understand these two differences, we can take the incident, take an incident from Mahabharata. This is at that phase where the Pandavas and Draupadi have been exiled to forest. They have taken up abode in Dvaitavana. Dvaita means duality, in very symbolical, Dvaitavana. And one day, Draupadi launches an attack on Yudhishthira. And in this beautiful conversation, which goes for about 7-8 chapters in Aranyakanda, we find example of the two kinds of logic, the lower logic and the higher logic. The lower logic represented by Draupadi and Bhima, and how well they articulate things, what different kinds of arguments they give in order to incite Yudhishthira to take up arms, to break his vows, promise, go back to Hastinapura and wage a war immediately. Versus Yudhishthira's stand, which is based on a higher understanding. Both of them give their reasoning, but the basis on which both of them are based is entirely different. For example, Draupadi first appeals to pity. She says, you know, I pity you, Yudhishthira. I pity you because you are supposed to be the king. You are supposed to give gifts to the Brahmanas. You are supposed to give gifts to the whole of the kingdom. You're supposed to be in luxury. But you are wearing deer skin and being here. I pity you. And then she says, I pity your brothers. Look at Bhima. He can slay 100 elephants single-handedly. Arjuna can slay an army. But they have all given up their arms and sitting here next to you, doing nothing, like sannyasis. And then forget about your own brothers. At least don't you have a duty towards Nakula and Sahadeva? Madri Devi's sons, Madri has given the charge of her sons to you. Don't you have duty towards them? And then she says, she appeals to his courage. You, the tiger among men, can't you wage war against Duryodhana and appeal to righteousness? She says, our kingdom has been taken to us by falsehood. It's not like it's been done through righteous means, and responding to it is our duty. Then appeal to the pride of Kshatriya. She says, there is a proverb which says that there is no Kshatriya in the world bereft of anger. I now behold in thee, however, a refutation of the proverb. Then appeal to ancestral nobility, appeal to religion and scriptures. She discusses the idea of God. She heaps insult on Yudhishthira. She even uses a distorted understanding of karma and reincarnation to incite Yudhishthira to break his promise and wage war, to get angry. And when she can't do any of this, and Yudhishthira gives his understanding or makes clear his stand, to which we will come next, then, as we usually do, she incites Bhima and keeps quiet. And Bhima, being anger itself, rage itself, the arguments that he makes, one should only take time to read, and the insults that he heaps on Yudhishthira is unthinkable. He says things like, have you lost your manliness? And he says that, you know, a raging bull, when its head has been cut off, lies lifeless on the ground. In similar manner, you are lying lifeless here in the forest, wearing deer skin like a sannyasi or a Brahmin, saying forgiveness, forgiveness. What kind of a Kshatriya are you? Have you lost your manliness? You know, the kind of assaults that they make. And Yudhishthira tries his best, just like Socrates tries his best to bring about a change in calculus in Republic. He tries his best to bring about a change in Bhima and Draupadi, and both are basically completely unconvinced about Yudhishthira's arguments. Then finally, Yudhishthira has to resort to more of a utilitarian, so to say, pragmatic arguments and says, okay, we are only 5 of us there, 10,000 of them. Do you think you can go and wage a war now? Keep quiet for now. And thankfully for Yudhishthira's, say, you know, Yudhishthira's good fortune, Vyasa appears out of thin air in the midst of this deep conflict between the brothers and assigns each one of them certain tasks, delegates some work to them, distracts their mind, and vanishes into thin air. So he avoids a sort of conflict between the Pandavas. And we have to consider the arguments that Yudhishthira gives to see what is this light of higher reason, right? See, basically, mind you, Draupadi here symbolizes our personality, our personal self, or that part of our mind and thinking and desiring and motivating nature, which is entirely based upon personal security and happiness. Draupadi represents that. Her whole argument is, and she is deeply intellectual, very well read, quotes the scriptures, everything. But the foundation, look at the foundation of her argument. It is this. Virtues are mere utilities. She says things like, humility is good. But it is only good because it will yield you certain fruits in the world. It is not good in itself. It will yield you certain good fruits. People will praise you. People will honor you. Therefore, humility is good. Forgiveness also is good, but only in measured proportions. You have to forego forgiveness and punish people. Otherwise, your servants will take advantage of you. I mean, the kind of logic that she gives makes you feel that virtues are, for Draupadi, only mere utilities to be used for what purpose? For the sake of personal security and comfort. But Yudhishthira, the arguments that he gives are also very sound, very logical. But look at the foundation that he is using. Yudhishthira's logic is founded on my personal good is not as important as the good of the society. Point number one. Secondly, supremacy of virtue over personal conveniences. I will give up my personal conveniences, personal comfort and security, but there is a greater good which I am not ready to give up, which is virtues. Right? And thirdly, virtues are innate laws. They are not human constructs. For Draupadi, they are human constructs. They are utilities, they are tools, you use them. For Yudhishthira, they are realities. I don't use virtues. I abide by the virtues and, so to say, the virtues use me. It's an entirely different paradigm that Yudhishthira is giving us. And finally, virtue results in good, however delayed it may appear to our mind. As the saying goes, the mill of the gods grinds slowly, but they grind very fine. The mill of the gods grind slowly, but they grind very fine. And he says things like, the time will come when we may have to wage war. But even though if I have to kill the son of Dhritarashtra, Duryodhana, I don't need anger for it. There is no need for me to get angry. Anger will only destroy me and not Duryodhana. Right? And he says things like, Suyodhana deserves not the kingdom. Look at his insight. Suyodhana deserves not the kingdom. Therefore, has he been unable to acquire forgiveness? I, however, deserve the sovereignty, and therefore it is that forgiveness has possessed me. That is, in other words, he is seeing the character of the person and deciding the destiny of the person. It is the character of the person which is deciding what happens to him in the future. And you give up your character, you have built for yourself a destiny full of sorrow and misery. But you hold on to virtue, you hold on to moral probity, character. Your future is assured. And he says many other interesting things. He says that the time will come, and if Dhritarashtra yields to temptation, he will meet with destruction. He told this years before the war started. He will meet with destruction, and a crisis has come in the history of the race of the Bharatas and so on and so forth, right? So this is a contrast between using logic for personal good, which appears very seductive and very attractive and very reasonable, and using logic with a higher, more universal basis, right? The tragedy of this civilization, or tragedy of any civilization which goes headlong into destruction, is a loss of ideals, loss of the right kind of universal ideals. Thomas Taylor, why Thomas Taylor? Plato himself says that the progress of human race happens through cycles. It's not a linear progress. It happens through cycles. And there are times when which there is periods of fertility. There are periods of abundance. There are periods of righteousness, periods of light and illumination. And then there is times when it is periods of darkness, delusion, despondency, despair, and barrenness. By even a mere simple analysis of our civilization, we see that we are not in a period of fertility, we are in a period of barrenness, because man's spiritual insight is clouded. There are two catastrophic consequences which Thomas Taylor speaks of, the great Platonist. When there is a period of barrenness, I will read this. He says, the most dreadful consequence attending a barren period with respect to mankind is this, that in such a period, they, that is mankind, has or have no scientific theology. They have no scientific theology. And secondly, they deny the existence of the immediate progeny of ineffable cause of things. In other words, he's saying the religion which man takes and cherishes would have lost its scientific character. Point number one. And when man reasons and thinks, he is not basing his thinking on universal principles, but on personal basis, which can only lead to destruction. This is a two predominant catastrophes or even characteristics of barren period. And we find that our entire civilization seems to be built on these two or permeated with these two characteristics. So a true philanthropic effort will be one which will try to restore to mankind the basis for higher reasoning, the basis for thinking, by promulgating, disseminating ideas which are universal. In other words, it should provide us a basis wherein I, without resorting to any belief or without taking anybody's authority, I, by myself, by my own reasoning powers, can come up with a scientific basis for ethical life. The religions of today cannot do that. The science of today has washed its hands off. from such a thing, right? Because both science and religion, to take the example of Adam and Eve, who got separated later but were earlier one, science and religion were earlier one body of knowledge. Later they became two, almost like one catering to the belief part of man, my need to believe in something, another catering to my cogitating, thinking animal brain only. Science and religion have taken, occupied these two places. Whereas there is a third option for mankind without taking any faith, without having faith in anything. I can still reason, think for myself by taking those universal premises and arrive at a code of conduct for myself, arrive at an ethical life, arrive at an arrangement of a society which is deeply ethical, beneficial, good of all. That body of knowledge, which when we study, we find it in theosophy, it is that body of knowledge, that promulgation of that, study of that, and application of that in life, that provides happiness for mankind. And here we have to see, we have to mention a couple of things and then we will close. As long as we take any of the religion as a basis for our thinking, there are a few problems that come. One is that there are internal contradictions among religions. For example, within a religion, there are contradictory codes of conduct. And between two religions, though, certainly there is differences in codes of conduct and behavior and outlook of life and so on. But a student of theosophy finds, by proceeding from universal ideas, that he is able to find not contradiction in religions, but commonality between them. Just as physically we all appear separate and we have different physical characteristics and traits, even mentally, emotionally and so on. But inwardly, innately, there is the same consciousness, same spirit, same life in all. In the similar manner, in all religions, there is a common sutratman, a common thread of connectivity, a scientific basis which runs through all religion, which can be found out. And taking that as the basis, you'll find that all religions have are speaking of the same thing. And secondly, there may be an objection that may be raised that, okay, the masters have given all this as their understanding of realities of life. Why should I take that as a basis of my thinking? I have not experienced those realities. Is not taking them amounting to taking them on belief and faith, which you'd say you should not do? Here, look at a couple of things. One is, even currently, as we are, every single person have certain metaphysical ideas which we have taken unquestioned, given to us by our education, parents, society, and so on. And we have held it as unquestioned truths. And we have been thinking from those bases already. We all have a basis for thinking. That basis is usually unexamined. This is what Schumacher says very nicely. He says, I have argued all along, no system of machinery or economic doctrine or theory stands on its own feet. It is invariably built on a metaphysical foundation. That is to say, upon man's basic outlook on life, its meaning and its purpose. I have talked about the religion of economics. We all think economics is merely mathematics and very abstract and very accurate and so on. He's telling, no, that is not the case. Economics is a religion. Why? It has the idol of worship of material possessions. What is the idol of that religion? Material possessions and its worship is the idol and the ritual. And consumption, standard of living, fateful propensity, which says that what was luxuries to our fathers have become necessities to us and so on. I mean, this kind of economics has its own metaphysical basis. Science has its own metaphysical basis. So today, we all have our own metaphysical basis, which we have not examined. What the masters of wisdom, the sages say is, okay, you take this, your current mode of thinking and its basis as one hypothesis, and take these other ideas which we have found as universally true as another, and reason along both of these lines and see what explains life better and see what leads to better society, more humane, more just, more compassionate. See what explains life and then choose. So there is one, the lower logic, which is based on our personal comfort, impressions that our senses give us, and then the higher logic, which is based on spiritual insights, which we can directly apprehend, not to be taken on belief, examined and experienced for oneself. So these are some ideas about the darkness of lower logic and the light of higher reasoning. So, any thoughts, questions, please raise.